Hello and welcome to Answer Me This. Thank you for listening.
If you've just heard some ads, please know we do not control which commercials you get to hear.
But now they're done, here is an episode of Answer Me This. Hello and welcome to Answer Me This. Thank you for listening.
If you've just heard some ads, please know we do not control which commercials you get to hear.
But now they're done, here is an episode of Answer Me This.
If I go to the beach with you, will I catch crabs?
Answer me this, answer me this.
When will 70s kids get over sherbet dip dabs?
Answer me this, answer me this. Helen and Ollie, answer me this.
We have an authoritative response to the discussion about Cinderella's blue dress.
Thank God.
Yes.
I don't know about you, but I haven't been sleeping the past fortnight.
That's because the dress is so uncomfortable to wear in bed, isn't it? Very synthetic.
Someday my answer will come, I've been singing to myself.
Annie says, I just wanted to chime in about Cinderella's dress with some inside information.
Ooh.
My former job was in costumes with Disney on Ice, and I can assure you that on my show, Cinderella's dress is silver with a light blue sheen. Like a glacier.
Yeah, Annie's attached a photo to prove this, and all I can say, Annie, is bibbidi-bobbidi-bothered, because...
bibbidi-bobbidi-blue, you should have said.
Because looking at it, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, yes, I accept your definition, but I would say there's still a case there to say that is actually light blue.
I also thought light blue, Ollie.
Yeah.
And like you described last time,
exactly.
An ice blue.
So I'd refer you to my previous answer and say, yes, it is. I said all along, it is white with a shimmer of blue. But I think when you then manifest that in cuddly merchandise in the Disney store for $25 a pop, it comes out as light blue. They can't do that kind of nuance.
They can't do that kind of skimmed milk colour.
Exactly. Incidentally, the whole Disney on Ice thing...
Yes.
Did you ever go?
Of course not!
No.
Did that even exist in Britain when we were growing up?
I must have been two or three times in my life.
Of course you have. Do you like it?
Never liked it.
Why did you go two or three times then?
Because it's just something your grandparents can take you to when you live near Wembley.
Oh. Well, I don't have that experience.
It's definitely better than Wembley Fruit Market. to an eight-year-old.
What about Fruit on Ice? Did you enjoy that little crossover?
Did you ever go to Disney on Ice, Martin?
Did you ever go to any kind of thing on ice?
Any ice-based extravaganza?
The Black Country Living Museum
on
ice?
I went to Telford Ice Rink. So I was on ice.
Yeah, Martin on ice.
It's pretty good.
The thing is with Disney on Ice is, especially in the 80s when Disneyland Paris hadn't opened yet, the novelty of seeing those costumes, you know, Mickey and Minnie and all the rest, in the UK was enough. Enough. It does not need to be on ice as well.
Yeah, but them just standing around... Would that be as good?
I would have liked a vaudeville-style show.
Like the Rockettes, but made of Disney.
Like an End of the Pier show starring my favourite Disney characters. That's what I wanted.
You would like to recast a chorus line with Disney characters.
Exactly.
That would be good, actually.
But the ice thing... And don't get me wrong, I know there's like a Germanic vibe to Snow White and Cinderella, and they sort of live in the forest, so they may have encountered ice in their life.
Yes, and also there are a lot of balls where there's probably ice in the drinks.
Nonetheless, now, I mean, I was just looking at the Disney on Ice website. And don't get me wrong, Frozen makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Frozen has come along and 30 years later legitimised Disney on Ice.
Yeah, but the problem there is people will be disappointed if you don't get a full castle made of ice and it's just a flat rink.
Well, which might be why the current stars of Disney on Ice are the Prince and Princess from The Princess and the Frog.
Really?
Now, that's the black princess that lives in Louisiana. They definitely don't see ice there.
Not in great quantities.
Doesn't really go along with the music and the style of the thing, which is all about, you know, life in the bayou.
Does the frog not live in liquid water as well, rather than water in its solid state?
So it would die in ice, possibly.
Or hibernate, whatever frogs do.
I suppose what I'm saying, Disney on Ice, is let it go. Now, you remember as well that we were discussing vasectomies in Answer Me This 318. Well, Ellie in Gypsy Hill... has written in to say, regarding the snip and whether one can check its success oneself using a microscope. Sadly, says Ellie, for my childhood memories of using my Toys R Us chemistry set, my family has a story that confirms this is possible. My dad had a vasectomy when I was a child. I found this out at the age of 22 when it came up in a conversation at a family dinner.
Oh, would you like more potatoes, darling? Oh, do you remember when your father had his vas deferens severed?
Can you give us that microwave pouch? You just need to snip the end off and put it in.
Oh, you want more gravy, do you? Well, there is none.
Following the operation, says Ellie, my dad was too embarrassed to go back for the wanking into a cup part of the process.
Why is that the embarrassing part? Surely that is post the most embarrassing parts.
My mum didn't trust that it had worked without confirmation, says Ellie. So, he used the microscope from the children's chemistry set my brother and I had at the time to check his own output.
Great. How did that go?
I don't have any younger siblings, she says, so it was clearly effective.
But I do have a microscope covered in spunk.
So he wasn't too embarrassed to use a children's toy, but he was too embarrassed to see medical professionals. What a man of inconsistencies.
This is Nick from Hitchin. Helen and Ollie, answer me this. I'm cooking dinner for my wife, one of our standard lazy evening weeknight dinners. It's pasta with spicy sausage, basil and mustard. It's in the Nigel Slater book. There is a great big product shot showing a huge tub of whole grain mustard, and the finished product also in the picture looks like it's got a whole grain mustard, but the ingredients list says Dijon mustard, and my wife and I always argue over this one. If I cook it, I do it with the whole grain mustard in the picture. If she does it, she does it with the Dijon mustard. Both taste nice, although we both think our version is better. So answer me this. Who is right? Is it the person that did the product shots, or is it the person who wrote and proofread and approved the text in the recipe? That would resolve a long-standing disagreement for us. Thank you, bye!
I don't understand the problem if both versions are nice.
I totally understand the problem. You've bought a celebrity cookbook. You want to know which part of the book is authentically the voice of the celebrity speaking to you through your $9.99 gift. Is it the recipe as written verbatim from Nigel Slater's own mouth?
Or the picture taken by food stylists?
Well, this is it. I mean, we've debunked the whole food stylist bollocks before, and therefore on that basis it is more likely, isn't it, that a food writer has written the words than taken the picture.
And someone else has been sent out to buy mustard. Which mustard? Oh God, I don't know!
Yeah.
But I've seen versions of this from the book online, including Nigel's own Observer column.
Bloody hell, you've done some proper research, Helen.
Of course, this is very important!
Glory
be! Bringing down their marriage for years. So the version in Nigel Slater's Observer column from, I think, 2001, specifies grainy mustard.
Grainy? Well, that's what whole grain
exactly.
mustard is.
However, the version on the BBC website to go with one of his TV series specifies a spoonful of both grainy and Dijon mustard.
Okay.
So maybe you should just do that and save your marriage. Yay!
Maybe Nigel Slater, you know, we think of him as being this food expert.
Unassailable.
Maybe he's actually quite erratic and clumsy. Maybe he handed in a whole load of notes to the publisher and he's like, I'll just put some of these recipes
He
together.
Just wrote random food words on a piece of paper. He's like, put them together in something that sounds nice.
Yeah, I'm sure that's basically what Ottolenghi does a lot of the time. Just like cream.
Sumac.
Yeah.
Freaker.
Pomegranate and guitar straps from Arabia. That sounds fine.
Right, I'm off to brunch.
Like David Bowie lyrics, basically. Just big word soup.
I like cut-ups. The William Burroughs technique is applied to recipes.
Yeah.
Nice.
That seems actually plausible.
Maybe this tells us more about Nigel Slater's inconsistency than it does about any fault at the publisher or within your ridiculously pedantic marriage.
Maybe Nigel Slater likes both grainy mustard and smooth mustard.
Yeah, but then he should have specified, but
he
did in the BBC recipe.
It's like,
I mean, as usual, the extra research that our public service broadcaster puts into things is worth the licence fee, folks. Hashtag save the BBC.
But what if sometimes he prefers the grainy version, sometimes the smooth, but he likes them generally just as much as the other one, so he doesn't want to make a call, but it's all according to the tide of his mustard mood at the time.
If we were to make this recipe now, which mustard would you choose?
Depends which mustard we've got in the house, which is almost certainly just going to be smooth English mustard.
Now, you see, now this is interesting, this business about substituting ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
I'm someone who, if I'm making a recipe, and I don't very often because it's a pain in the ass and I'm not very good at it.
Like reading.
But if I'm going to make a recipe, I'll take a picture of the book.
Yes.
And take my smartphone to the supermarket and buy everything on there, even if some of it clearly is just store cupboard ingredients and I've got something very similar.
Even if it's like garnish with parsley.
Yeah.
You buy the parsley.
Buy the parsley.
If you put it on the side, don't you?
Yeah, and then waste it, yeah. Even if it says, you know, white cider vinegar instead of red cider vinegar, things like that, I will buy exactly what it says.
Okay, why is that?
Because I'm following the recipe, and so I want the minimum amount of blame on myself.
Oh, I see. Mm. When it's just absolving yourself from responsibility, I do get it.
Mm. So I would actually, and this is why I understand the concern here, I would go and buy Dijon mustard, especially to make this recipe, even if I had five other types of mustard.
I have to say, though...
To find out afterwards that whole grain would have been acceptable, I'd be fucking fuming.
In the Marie Shagkill situation, I would definitely kill Dijon mustard.
Yeah. I've got an idea, though.
Mm.
Perhaps you could do a blind taste test, get around a panel of trusted friends, you and your wife both prepare equal quantities of your mustard pasta, and thus prove by jury which is the best mustard?
No, it's not a blind... because the flavours of Dijon and whole grain are so distinct. No, it's cheese based on the preference for which kind of mustard, not the how well it works in the recipe.
I don't think in a recipe with spicy sausages you're going to know that exactly which mustard you got.
That's right. Interesting.
Unless you're sensitive to the texture of the grains.
Here's a question from Cheesy, who says, Helen, answer me this. Who is Simon, as in the popular children's party game, Simon Says?
The Simon that is most cited online, but based on a Yahoo article which itself does not offer any evidence for this assertion, is the Roman historian and orator Cicero.
Okay.
So it could either be a corruption of Cicero Says, or just total bullshit. and then the other historical contender, slightly more convincingly, is Simon de Montfort, the 6th Earl of Leicester, who captured Henry III and his son, the future King Edward I, at the Battle of Lewes. And it meant that for the next year, every order that Henry III gave could have been overturned by Simon de Montfort until he was defeated at the Battle of Evesham.
I'm shocked that kids don't remember that when it's told to them.
Simon Says, countermand that law.
Well, so the king was nominally ruling, but because the king was captive, Simon was effectively ruling.
Yeah.
Precisely, so it makes more sense of why you'd be following Simon.
So I think that's a good story, but I also think it's a bullshit story, and I'm not sure that there's a real Simon. It could be Simon the Apostle. He was quite authoritative.
Or Paul Simon.
Yes.
He's quite charismatic.
He's bossy, isn't he?
He is quite bossy.
Yeah.
In Art Garfunkel's world, that is the Simon.
That would be fun, wouldn't it, if you did the counterbalance. You know, Simon says, put your hands on your head. Garfunkel says, just be that man.
This is a game I would love to play.
This like Michael Jackson.
Yeah. Simon says, sit on the floor. Garfunkel says, just forget about it. I actually always disliked Simon Says as a game.
No one tells an only child what to do.
I think I disliked the groupthink. That was the thing. And it was partly because I didn't know. I was like, who the fuck's Simon?
Sheep against her invisible lord.
Simon's got something to say to me. Come here and say it himself. Don't hide behind you, party entertainer dressed as a clown.
It's basically Scientology for kids, isn't it?
Exactly. Exactly. And it never seemed to me either to tally with that classic teacher's refrain. Oh, you only did that because Helen did it, did you?
Yeah.
Well, if Helen told you to run under a bus, would you do that? Well, if Helen told you to jump off a cliff, would you do that? No, I wouldn't.
Oh.
Right? But if you told me to push someone in the face, I would, because it's funny.
Right? If I tell you to do what you want to do, then you're into it.
Fine.
It's odd that you'll allow yourself to be ruled by cookbooks and not humans.
But the point is, the teacher would say that and then in the same breath say, let's play a game of Simon's Says.
Yeah.
And I think, hypocrite.
It's a bit like the Divine Right of Kings, isn't it, really? It's a sort of appeal to authority.
Well, in other countries, Simon Says is called Master or King instead of Simon. So does figure.
Ah. Mm-hmm. Now that's interesting because we actually still have a monarchy.
Yeah, so
if here it was called the King Says, you'd sort of be training children to understand the importance of monarchistic rule.
But it's impossible to understand the importance of monarchistic rule since it is completely useless.
That's true. I've taken more instructions from a fictional Simon than I have from Queen Elizabeth II.
And yet she gets all the stamps. Unfair.
If you got a question, email your question to answer me this podcast at googlemail.com. Answer me this podcast at googlemail.com. It's great.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Here's a question for you, Helen, from Rupert in Richmond, who says, my daughter has started doing arts and crafts at nursery. Even you didn't start that early, did you?
I think at nursery I was learning ancient Greek.
Yes, I was going to say, you were Latin literate before you even picked up a needle. And she comes home, says Rupert, all the time with stuff that has glitter all over it, and it gets absolutely everywhere. Helen, answer me this. What is glitter, and how do you make it?
Well, Rupert, glitter is mainly made out of shredded plastic or paper that has been chemically coated with paint or aluminium or aluminium has been baked on it.
You are ruining all the magic. I now assume there was some kind of labour camp for pixies and fairies where they make this stuff out of their bums.
It's just crap, isn't it? It's like when we learnt how hundreds and thousands were made. And it was just as unromantic as how they make plastic packing beads. The plastic is usually mylar, so it's kind of like making one of those big space blankets. It's the same process they use to make foil crisp packets.
Yeah, it sounds quite specialised.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, like when there was that hummus health scare about 5 years ago.
What?
And it turned out...
The enemy all along.
It turned out that M&S hummus and Tesco hummus and Sainsbury's hummus, it's all different prices, all slightly different ingredients, you know, different quantities of tahini and garlic, all made in the same factory. So when there was an outbreak of whatever, listeria or whatever it was in the factory, all humai was affected across all supermarkets.
And the British middle classes were wiped out within days.
Within days. They were malnourished within a week. I wonder if glitter's a bit like that. I wonder if actually all glitter, you know, the ones that come in the £50 Harrods crackers and the ones that come in the pound shop crackers actually come from the same place because it's glitter.
Yeah. You can't really tell. I suppose with the Harrods stuff, you might put it under a microscope and found that it's made of actual ground diamonds or something. But glitter was invented by a cattle rancher.
How come?
Maybe just like things that were shiny and you missed them just being surrounded by unshiny cows all the time.
There probably is an agricultural purpose for it, actually, though, isn't there? Birds get frightened or attracted to shiny things, don't they?
Yeah, well, I think it was an accident, like so many discoveries are. This guy in 1934 was doing his hobby, which was being a machinist, and he thus accidentally discovered how to make the machine cut these minute little bits of shiny.
And how were they first used?
1934... That was during quite an austere era, wasn't it?
Yes, there wasn't a great deal of festivity going on.
Yeah.
I actually miss glitter during the rest of the year. Because I don't have children, I only really see glitter at Christmas.
We used to have a glitter toilet seat. I missed that.
That was great.
Yeah.
But the point is, like, it's weird, isn't it? Like, January to November, no glitter. Then suddenly, December,
everything.
Bam, common as muck. Glitter everywhere. Glitter falling out of cards, glitter stuck to the wall.
But then you do get glitter the rest of the year because it's in your carpet.
Yes, and of course that's the affliction that Rupert is referring to.
It's like a shiny virus, isn't it?
Do you know what? It's actually better, though, than... I don't even know the vocabulary for this, the word for this, but when I was 7, I went to see The Muppet Show live.
Yes, and on ice.
It wasn't on ice.
And on dry land.
And therefore I was happy. And
the last time I was truly happy.
It was really good, actually. They had Statler and Waldorf up in the Royal Box. They did the whole thing properly. I don't actually remember the show, but I remember being very excited because I was in the same room as Kermit. Anyway... I was like off my tits on Fanta. But in the audience, they, you know, like now when you go to bonfire night, they have those special torches that people have just on bonfire night and you never see them any other time that have like UV stuff in.
Well, like those little rave bracelet things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They didn't have those. This predated the technology of those. So what they had in the mid 80s instead of that was a battery operated little pin torch with like a Duracell AA battery in it. And then at the end, these like strands of some kind of polymer. Do you remember those?
Oh,
and they'd all be different colours at the end.
Yes,
and
like a fibre optic brush.
Yes, fibre optic brush, yeah. And that, I mean, I was just tripping on it.
Yes,
you know,
quite
like,
right.
Like a 17-year-old at an ecstasy party.
Probably staring at one of those same things, because you used to be able to get those light fittings as well, where you just looked at a big bunch of fibre optic spangles.
But then, of course, I took it home. The battery ran out.
Oh, no.
And then one day I stepped on it.
Oh, the magic was broken.
Shards. Shards and shards and shards in my family carpet for, I mean, I would say a decade. The cat was eating them. They were getting in between your feet.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary. So you don't know how lucky you've got it, actually, Rupert. Glitter ain't so bad. You know, though, I was at a folk festival yesterday.
I didn't know that.
No,
really?
That's not the bit I was testing. No. But I was. It was good. My friends who I was with, Ben and Nikki, their little girl Charlotte was with us, who's 2 years old. And I didn't realise this until I went, but apparently 2-year-olds don't really like folk. So,
oh, really?
So,
what are they into then? Like Delta Blues?
So I think more into bluegrass.
Extraordinarily, at some point between Mary Chapin Carpenter and Bellowhead, Charlotte wanted to go and do something else. So they took her to the story tent, and she went and did that. But then they took her to the Lavender Pit. And this is a new thing that I've never seen. Have you seen that before? A lavender pit?
Isn't that what they used to call latrines?
Yeah.
Wasn't that used to be the jail that they would put gay men in before being gay was legal?
It's a sand pit.
Yes.
With loads and loads of little chopped up bits of lavender.
This sounds great.
Like a potpourri for two-year-olds.
Kiddie potpourri to and cover then, up the smell of their shit and piss.
What's amazing is they were so amused and excited. Like, honestly, 35 minutes went by. I mean, a good 7 Mary Chapin Carpenter songs. And Charlotte was just scooping up lavender and pouring it over her head, pouring it over another baby's head, pouring it on the floor, touching the lavender.
Like a lavender baptism.
And I was like, wow, you don't even need glitter, really.
No.
You know, if you offer them anything they can hold and play with, they're sort of, that sounds wrong, but you know what I mean. Anything that's small and attractive to them, they'll play with.
Yeah, anything that's monotonous and seemingly has no appeal to you.
Yeah.
Here's a question from Preston. He says, Ollie, answer me this. Ritz. Biscuits or hotel, which came first? Are they connected? If so, why no Hilton wafers or Travelodge crackers? Because Travelodge is not giving you anything extra.
That's true, and actually there are Hilton biscuits, or for the Americans listening, Doubletree cookies. That's the thing. If you go to Doubletree by Hilton, they give you a free warm cookie. I say free, it's built into the price, probably costs £5 more to stay there, but that's their thing. If you stay at Doubletree, free cookie when you get there.
And if you go to Travelodge, you think it's a cracker, but it's actually your towel.
Anyway, point is, I don't think they even have ever served Ritz crackers at the Ritz, although I suppose, you know... I'm trying to think of a famous person that stayed there, and the first two names that came to my head were Michael Jackson and Joan Rivers, and I thought, oh, shit, what's the contemporary reference for someone who stays at the Ritz? Thatcher's dead. Who stays at the Ritz now?
Well, now I feel like I'm cursing somebody if I say that person stays at the Ritz.
Think of a person who's contemporary who would stay at the Ritz.
Well, I don't know. They would have to be pretty old, because otherwise you'd go to a slightly cooler place.
Yeah, like old glamour. Jackie Mason would probably stay at the Ritz when he's in London.
If he could afford it.
I reckon he'd stay at the Dorchester, really, but let's say. Okay, so Jackie Mason wants to order Ritz crackers to his room at the Ritz. I'm sure they'd do it for him. But
just so that he stopped complaining.
Just to dry out his mouth.
We should have taken some Ritz crackers for him in episode 206. Maybe would have hated us a bit less.
But anyway, in the dining room, there's never been any formal connection between Ritz crackers and the Ritz. The hotel came first, but it's not a coincidence. Ritz crackers were named after the Ritz Hotel in a very pre-copyright era kind of way.
Was it to give the impression of fanciness whilst offering nothing of the kind?
Indeed. And that's, in fact, related to your glitter history a moment ago, because in the same sort of time, same sort of period, 1934, I think the Ritz cracker was invented.
And then they crumbled it and said that could be glitter, you know.
it came out of the Depression era America. Yeah. People wanted affordable snacks. So this was something that made people feel a bit better about the fact they just lost all their money and they didn't have a job. They could afford a Ritz cracker that glimmered because it was buttery, compared to other crackers, which only reminded them of their poverty.
Aww. But also, there were a lot of decades in which very processed, kind of crappy by today's standards, foods were pretty classy.
Well, because the whole notion of a processed food that would be the same in every city was sort of, I wouldn't go as far to say glamorous, but was a novelty,
kind of magnificent, wasn't it?
Yes.
Particularly post-Second World War.
Yes.
Even First World War, they were like, we've just been eating sawdust for 4 years. Give us that turkey Twizzler thing.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting, isn't it? Like, people now talk about, oh, the war generation, you know, they knew how to make food from scratch, and they had time for each other, and they were good neighbours, and
they didn't have TV.
Whereas actually, it was exactly that generation who, at the first opportunity, were like, give me a fucking fridge. I want a microwave.
Yeah, give me white bread.
I want to go on jumbo jets, and I want to forget that the war happened.
And has the Ritz never tried to shut down this menace that threatens to overtake their brand recognition?
I think not, because that would seem a little bit below their brand.
But what crackers do they serve at the Ritz with cheese? I bet... they're not particularly classy crackers. I bet they're those like Hovis ones that look like a miniature loaf of bread that come in a multi-pack.
Yes, but I bet they're not the ones that you buy in Marks and Spencer. I bet they're ones you can only get in very, very expensive food halls.
They'll be ones you can get in Fortnum's, but they won't taste any better.
Yeah, they'll be from Switzerland, but they'll be the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think we're all agreed on that. And that's what you want from the Ritz, and that's why Ritz wouldn't demean themselves by trying to sue a cracker company.
What does Ritz actually mean?
The hotel was named after its founder.
Oh, Mr. Ritz.
Swiss hotelier César Ritz. And his nickname was King of Hoteliers and Hotelier to Kings, which sounds like an introduction to a pro wrestler.
So presumably the adjective Ritzy is just comparing something to the Ritz.
To the Ritz Hotel, yeah. Huh. Which actually, I mean, I think in the long run, all of this stuff has helped the Ritz's brand image.
Yeah.
The Ritz cracker being an absolutely entry-level product that every American preschooler eats at some point means that they are going to grow up, if they ever start earning $100,000 a year, to think, I'm going to stay at the Ritz.
Yeah.
I think there is an association that's been helpful for them. I don't think it would be useful for them to shut it down.
Do you think psychologically we think Ritz crackers are better than Tuck biscuits, even though they're basically the same substance, just because there isn't a Hotel Tuck on Piccadilly?
There's the trade unions congress.
It's true, but it's just not quite as glamorous. Well, listeners, I don't know if any of you have actually stayed in the Ritz and have any...
I can be pretty sure.
you might have some inside scoop on what crackers they actually use there. Or if you're going to the Ritz this summer on your summer holiday. But if you're not, and just hazard a guess that the majority of you are not, perhaps you could have a cheaper getaway by buying the Answer Me This holiday album.
It's available on iTunes, it's available on Amazon, and it's available for just £2.49 from our own shop,
answermethisstore.com. If you want to give us all of the money instead of large corporations.
Indeed. And it's an album all about, and by album we basically do just mean hour long edition of the podcast, all about going away on holiday,
foreign
hotels,
travel,
weird stuff that happens in other places.
And today's intermission is one such weird thing happening to Ollie in another place.
Sex on the beach, the way they do it, it's very precise, and if you haven't been there, you'll think I'm making this up, but this is institutionalised across Cancun as a resort. The ladies throw your head back, pour it down your mouth, swing your head from side to side, pinch your nipples, turn you over, smack you on the bum, and then rub their hand just below your groin and laugh.
That is such a violation. If it was male shots people doing that to women, there'd be an absolute uproar.
That's right, although the women often elect to have it done, but it is female shot pourers.
I get very uncomfortable if in conversation someone lightly touches my arm. I would not cope well with
nipple
that.
Squeeze.
Okay. But whenever I make Martin a cup of tea, I throw it down his mouth and slap him on the arse.
I don't know about you, Helen, but I am ready to hear a question from our phone line.
I am always ready for that, Ollie.
Well, just because I said I didn't know, that didn't mean I was curious. Oh. Here's the number.
02081235877.
And you can Skype Answer Me This.
Hello, my name is Sarah from Riverside, California. Please answer me this. I live with my mom, a housemate, and the housemate's girlfriend. The girlfriend is new, has lived here for less than a year. For 6 years before that, another girlfriend of his lived here, and she and I were our pretty good friends. Every year we have an Independence Day party at the house, and this year I invited the old girlfriend. So my question is, does this make me an asshole?
I think if you did not consult with your housemate and his girlfriend and just went ahead and did it, does make you a bit of an asshole.
Well, you don't have to use the word asshole. I mean, I think if she didn't confer in advance... that makes you almost endearingly insensitive, like a kind of idiot savant for rudeness. But certainly I would agree with Helen's suggestion that the convention would be to run it past the ex-boyfriend before you invite her back round to the house when the new girlfriend will be there, in a way that will remind everyone that they used to be together.
Yeah. I mean,
that would be polite, wouldn't it?
Also, you run the risk of them retaliating next year by inviting your elementary school bully or something.
Exactly.
I think also, because it sounds like their breakup is relatively recent, it's too soon for this. Whereas if it was 5 or 10 years down the line, there'd be some curiosity to bumping into an old flame.
I mean, also, the new girlfriend might be totally cool with it. So you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a problem. But the reason you are a bit of an asshole is you haven't really thought about her feelings at all.
And you live with this woman.
and she may take it as, and this would be wrong, but I've known women to behave in this way, and you can choose to call it irrational if you want. She may take it as... you prefer the old girlfriend to me.
Yes.
Even though it's not inviting her to be the girlfriend, it's just inviting her as your friend, she might take it as undercutting her role at the party, which is to be his girlfriend.
Maybe you should have got your mum to decide, since she lives with all of you and she's probably quite a good adjudicator, slightly more removed from it all.
Well, I think everyone would probably say, you know what, this year, Sarah, give it a rest. I think actually we are saying you're an arsehole, Sarah. I think actually in conclusion,
don't want to, Sarah.
No,
but
just
that
a bit of an arsehole.
That was a bit of an arsehole-y thing to do.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. You're a glimpse of an arsehole through someone's shorts. You're not like a full, you know, splayed out.
Like Marilyn Manson.
I don't even remember. Did you just pick a name of someone you think is a bit of an arsehole?
He gets his bum out.
Does he?
Yeah, he kind of really popular, waves his anus around. Yeah.
Right, okay.
Well, I don't know if he still does.
Okay.
Having said that Sarah is a bit of an arsehole, though, I will defend her by saying I would kind of like to watch that showdown if I was at that party.
Mm.
Bit of a scrap is often fun to report afterwards. Oh, how was your 4th of July? Well.
Yes. Another question of international relations from Duncan, who says, I've been living in New Zealand for almost 9 years, and I'm very happy in my adopted home.
Seems like a happy place, New Zealand.
Mm. I plan to eventually take the final step and become a Kiwi, but not quite yet. As a permanent resident, I get almost all the benefits of being a Kiwi, so there isn't a particular hurry to naturalise.
Okay.
One benefit, though, I do get as a permanent resident is being allowed to vote in elections and referendums.
Ooh.
And I'm happy to do this, as it affects me just as much as it does the Kiwis. But I have something of a quandary coming up. In the next year, New Zealand will be voting on whether or not to change their flag.
A debate that's been raging since the early 70s.
I had no idea.
No.
Why? Because it's got the Union Jack on it, basically.
Yeah.
I don't know enough about Kiwis as to whether or not they're going to... Australians, I think, would ultimately get rid of the Union Jack. You know, there's a few royalists left, aren't there? But ultimately, they'll get rid of it. But Kiwis, I don't know. I reckon they probably quite like having a slightly more important country on their flag.
Well, the fact that it's taken them 40 years to get around to referending this makes it seem like they don't want to make too much of a fuss about the flag.
Anyway, Duncan continues, I'm not sure this is something I should vote on. It's not a matter of governance or taxation that affects me. It's a question of culture and nationalism that cuts deep into the meaning of being a Kiwi in the 21st century. And as such, it isn't something I really have a stake in.
But it is. If you've made your home there, then you're a Kiwi of the 21st century, aren't you? You've spent most of the 21st century thus far in New Zealand.
Well, he says, I have the right to vote in the referendum. I certainly have opinions. But Helen, answer me this. Should I vote on this issue? Sounds like you're leaning towards yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes. I'm referending myself right now.
I agree. I think yes too.
I always think if you have the possibility to vote, you should use it, even if you don't actually deliver a choice one way or another. Just demonstrate the fact that you appreciate your opportunity to vote.
This is Kiwis deciding the future for their own country, and you are part of that future, whether you're a citizen or not. If they change the flag, they're doing that because they want to choose a flag that represents who they are now, and you're part of that.
Yeah.
So if you'd be part of the new flag, then you're allowed to vote to be part of the old flag as well.
They've got public submissions for the new flag, and there are like 10,000 options that they're going to have to sift through.
One of them looks a bit like an embryonic alien. I quite like that one. One of them looks like a Kiwi bird smoking a silk cut. Some of them are a bit too playful. I wouldn't be at all surprised if in the end they end up choosing one that, like everyone else's flags, is basically stripes.
Well, I think you want a flag that is easily replicable. If you can't paint it on your face with ease at sporting events, then your flag has failed. That's what New Zealand needs to vote on.
Yes, I think you're right, actually, because ours is tricky to paint on your face, isn't it? Not England, but Britain.
The Union Jack is a good one to paint on your face, I think. Even if you get the colours the wrong way around in the Union Jack, people will know what you were trying to do.
Mm.
So I think that works, and it only requires three types of face paint. So I think that is a good one.
Right, okay.
The Black Country flag was designed by a child. It's quite good, I think. I mean, not uncontroversial.
So, explain the controversy, Martin.
It depicts chains on it to do with the fact that there were chainmakers in Black Country, and that's been linked to the history of British slavery, which is not a great connection.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't have necessarily associated the Black Country with chains more than, say, black pudding or stainless fasteners that you were manufacturing in the 1890s.
Ironwork and leatherwork and things like that were quite a big part of the Black Country. So, I mean, maybe it's just the way a 12-year-old parlays that into a tangible good. You can't communicate the concept of tannery.
You can communicate the concept of tannery, it's just a river of shit.
If you don't even know what a question is, then you're probably at the wrong place. Cause religion's on godcasts, dogs are on dogcasts, fish are on rodcasts, but we don't do fish. Cause on this podcast, you answer me this.
Here's a question from Nigel, who says, I have a rather unusual relationship with a lady who is a professional dominatrix. I am her personal slave.
That sounds like the usual relationship you would expect.
What this entails, says Nigel, is going round to her house, which she shares with her long-term partner, to clean once a week.
Ingenious. Good work, dominatrix.
So far, you just sound like a cleaner, Nigel. Yeah. Hate to break it to you. Buying her nice gifts.
This woman's
so
genius.
Cleaner meets sugar daddy. Sometimes being called up to do odd jobs.
Handyman.
Going out for food and drinks. Or maybe a day out.
That's where it gets weird.
Yeah.
Because that's almost like a relationship of equals.
Sometimes I massage her if she calls after a busy day.
Yep.
Sometimes I go to her dungeon where she can enjoy her sadistic hobbies.
That sounds more in keeping than the massaging.
Yes, I think that's the thing where you've definitely tipped the scale there into full-on dominatrix behaviour.
But maybe that is part of the thing that keeps you trembling in anticipation. Will she want a massage today, or will she want a stamp on my face?
Will we be going to Madame Tussauds, or will I be in the dungeon?
London dungeon.
Yeah, I guess.
It's probably a 2-for-1 ticket.
Probably is a 2-for-1
ticket. Tussauds attractions.
You know, they do a very good deal now. It's 5-for-1.
Really?
5-for-1.
So I can take the Clint Museum. Because I've never been there.
No, I think it's the Sea Life Aquarium.
Yeah.
Tussauds, the London Eye. the London Dungeon and something really
just
shit.
Just go to the Iron.
Really?
As long as it's a clear day.
Anyway, Nigel continues. She has a sadistic sense of fun, which turns me on, although she locks me in chastity.
I assume he means chastity belt.
Yet, says Nigel, she is also a really caring and nurturing person.
Well, it's because she's worked out all of her non-caring and nurturing traits at work.
Yeah, she knows how to nurture her housework through free assistance.
She is my new idol. I suppose that's how she gets people, isn't it?
Exactly.
Draws you in with a business plan, and then suddenly you're taking it to Madame Tussauds.
I feel lucky to be able to serve her in this position that I find myself.
That you're paying for?
Not clear.
If she's giving it to you for free and you want it, then yeah, you are lucky. If you're paying for it, then that just seems like the nature of the transaction, doesn't it? Who's paying for the tickets to the days out? So many questions. I mean, it's a detailed email, but there's so many questions.
Yeah. However, he says, I am in my early 30s.
Well, that changes everything.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a reasonably successful career working in the public sector in a very traditional and respected profession.
Mm-hmm.
Not a politician then. I go to the gym 5 times a week, so I'm in good shape, and I can attract women.
Oh, you've got it all
going
for you.
You've got the skill set. Helen, answer me this. Am I nuts?
Not sure that's relevant.
I think that's a very polite way to deal with that question.
Thanks.
Should I feel guilty? What's he feeling guilty about?
I don't know. Is it that the days out feel relationship-y, whereas the dominatrix stuff feels like the professional sub-dom situation?
No, I think this is good old bog-standard shame about his sexual proclivities, although he's written into us about it, but then he's a man of many contradictions.
He is, really. So he's not feeling guilty about their marriage. If her partner lives with her in a house in which there's a dungeon, I'd imagine he's fully aware of what she gets up to.
I think that's probably right. I mean, he says, just to clarify, in a postscript, there is no sex between us. That'll be because of the chastity belt, I would imagine.
And also, that is usually the way, isn't it, with the professional dominatrix situation?
Idea. Is that really... I thought it always was kind of foreplay that went on for ages, but it still ultimately led to some kind of sex. No?
I think the lack of sex is part of it, Ollie.
Oh, it's so much hornier, isn't it, when you definitely don't have sex?
It's so much hornier when you get kicked in the nuts.
weird, I say, but also fine. Like, you know, happy to celebrate it if that's your thing.
Yeah.
There is no sex between us. She is monogamous with her partner. I get let out of my cage, on average, every 6 weeks. I think he means the chastity thing, right?
Uh-huh.
You only get the chastity thing comes off every 6 weeks. Normally, she teases me with it on. She's just like, oh, you've got spots. And I should add...
you run funnily. Pigeon-toed.
And I should add, she is easily the best-looking woman I've ever known.
There are a lot of non-sequiturs here, going from the cage to the easily best-looking woman I've ever known. Like, what's the problem? You've got a woman doing her job,
yeah,
and you're having feelings that are completely irrelevant to that.
Yeah, that...
Maybe that's the problem.
Yes, I agree. I think, actually, the problem is... In this relationship, although he wouldn't call it that, in this transaction, although he might not be paying for it, he feels emotion.
Yeah.
And yet, his role in the transaction is to suppress that.
Yeah.
And to be in her hands.
Well, no.
And he likes that, but on reflection, he's like, but I've got all these emotions I haven't dealt with because I'm a man. I think that's what's happening.
Well, not necessarily because he's a man. He's got all these emotions.
No, because he's a person, I mean. Because he's a human being.
Yeah,
because
women can have those feelings.
I wasn't suggesting they couldn't.
So he seems to be getting confused. Like, she's just doing everything as normal, except maybe the outings, which does seem a bit weird. But
yeah.
She hasn't...
if she's a professional and she's using you for free, I wonder if she's abusing some sort of trade union code for domination.
Is there a contract? Often there's a contract.
Yeah. Anyway, by the by.
Check the terms and conditions. Mm. It's in the small print on the wall of your dungeon.
Yeah.
So she's maintaining monogamy. She's doing her dominatrix job, and you're feeling pleasure pain out of it. So everything is as it should be, isn't it? What's the problem here? The input and the output are exactly how they're supposed to be in this transaction.
The problem is there isn't an outlet for his emotions. That's why he's giving them to us.
Right.
He can't tell her that these things that he's feeling because that's not part of their relationship. That's the point.
Right, okay. Well, in that case, maybe find another dominatrix where you don't go on outings to Madame Tussauds and the lines are a lot more drawn.
That's what a psychologist would say. Write her a letter. You'd have to send it
to her. Don't send it. Yeah. Don't send it.
Write her a letter and then get it all off your chest instead of sending it to us because we're not your dominatrixes.
No, and also we are the most pathetically, dismally square people to ask this to.
I do find, I mean, I don't think I could be dominated or dominant to an extreme degree. Obviously,
you'll be dominated by a cookbook, but
in every sexual encounter, I dare say there's, you know, someone who's in control, someone who's slightly more passive, arguably. I don't think I could go to the extremity of that situation.
Well, people have different tastes, don't they?
But the point is, I think, as soon as you're completely sublimating control, you're in a rape fantasy situation. If I'm the person doing that, I'm thinking to myself, well, I'm a rapist then. I don't find that a turn on, even if the person I was doing it to wanted me to.
I think the idea in a lot of subdom situations is that it is actually the sub who has control, so that it doesn't then become
But then the fantasy situation is relinquishing control. I mean, if you're going to do it properly, like what they want, and in fact, it doesn't surprise me at all that you work in the public sector and you have a successful career and da-da-da-da. I mean, that's the point, isn't it? People who do these quite conservative, buttoned-up lives.
Yeah, they need some outlet.
Yeah, with responsibility all the time. Actually, I think very often that's why you're into it. Like, you want to, you want someone else to make decisions for you and tell you that you're not important.
Some people join village cricket teams. You've done this.
I sense that he's not been in relationships from his tone. It's like, women, I can attract women. He doesn't say, I've had girlfriends or I'm in a relationship or I've been in a relationship recently.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that what he really wants is a relationship with somebody where he can have a fulfilling emotional bond, and then there's, you know, they can have the sort of subdom sex stuff.
Yes.
So it's finding someone who's maybe not as extreme as being professional dominatrix, but who is open enough that that's not something that would freak them out.
Well, listeners, I don't know whether you can illuminate the dungeon
of Nigel's brain.
Yeah, because I think we're just all quite perplexed at what he actually needs from us, but if you have seen through his words...
I think he wanted a lot of banter about the Sea Life Aquarium. I think that's what he was after.
Stuff on the 5-for-1!
That's really going to give me pleasure pain. But if you can see through Nigel's words to the emotional world within and...
Well, just someone who isn't as square as the three of us, who actually can relate to what he's talking about.
Someone who's aced this situation.
Yeah, and to be clear, his question, because we've talked a lot around it, is, should I feel guilty? You know the answer to that? You know, if you've been through that yourself, should he feel guilty? Let us know. Drop us a line.
The answer's obviously no, isn't it?
If he gets off on feeling guilty, then that probably is an okay outcome.
A requisite, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's confusing.
It's a very complex question.
Indeed.
But do send your questions, complex or otherwise, to the contact details on our website.
AnswerMeThisPodcast.com. And I think it is true to say that your questions are both our pleasure and our pain.
And one day we'll take you all to the London Dungeon on a discount ticket.
What a promise.
Be like a flash mob.
Now, remember in the meantime to follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/AnswerMeThis, and Twitter as well. Yes, at Helen and Ollie.
It's fun to engage with you, online listeners.
And listen to our other projects as well, Helen.
The Allusionist, if you please. Fucking brilliant.
and also Tech Weekly, the Guardian's Tech Weekly podcast. I've been presenting it over the summer. Newsflash, I'm going to continue presenting it all year.
Summer loving.
What happened next? Did they alternate you with a woman? Yes, they did. And it's going to be great. That's all happening.
You were literally clapping with glee when you were talking about that.
I'm very excited. I'm very excited to be doing Tech Weekly. So, yes, I'm going to be presenting every other episode of Tech Weekly. So find it if you're interested in technology.
Marvellous.
Thanks.
I've just updated the Martin Sandman page on the Answer Me This website.
Holy shit.
You're kidding.
It's really old. I haven't done it for you. Anyway, I've put some music
of you when
there.
You're about 10 on there.
There's still a picture of me when I'm about 10.
Yeah, but there's
some more recent stuff I've
Was there still a picture of you riding a rocking horse at my parents' house?
I left that one in. I got rid of the one where I was eating the massive mezze because I looked...
You look adorable in that picture,
I look
Martin.
Young and I look really old now. So.
No, you don't. And we'll be back in a fortnight with the next Answer Me This.
Bye!